Hi, I'm Ed Sweeney, one of the pastors here at the Pelham Road campus. And when my family and I moved here and joined Grace Church 4 years ago, our church was entering a unique and new season in its 17-year history. We had just launched the Powdersville campus and were trying something new with multiple sites in an effort to reach our local communities in a more effective and powerful way. Now, 4 years later, here at the Pelham Road campus, we are celebrating the successful launch of 3 additional campuses, making us a 4-campus multi-site church. And we're looking to God and listening to what we believe He's saying about possibly starting a 5th. Every week, folks from the Spartanburg area and the surrounding communities there drive down to the Pelham campus and have been for years. And currently they're asking critical and exciting questions about what it would look like to start a campus in Spartanburg and reach their local community there as well. In 2012, 64 people publicly identified with Christ through baptism here at the Pelham Road campus. And 70 adults last month alone have pursued membership at Grace Church through our Foundations class. We are so excited and so thankful to God for these signs of health and growth. Just this fall, we've introduced Fusion, our ministry of 5th and 6th grade students, to our Saturday night service, and we are enjoying watching that grow each week. Our local community used to be the entire upstate of South Carolina, but now it's focused in on Greenville's east side. We believe that God has planted our church right here along the I-85 business corridor between Atlanta and Spartanburg for a reason. And a significant part of that reason is to reach the thousands of families that have moved into our area with companies like Michelin, BMW, and GE. The celebrations and the challenges that we currently find ourselves surrounded by are why I love being a part of Grace Church. There's always something that we can look back to and see where God has worked in our midst and be thankful for. But there's always something more that God's calling us to. I want to personally thank each of you for your generous and obedient giving to One Fund. It's because of that generous giving that we're able to do all that God has in front of us today. And it's with great hope and excitement that we look together ahead to the future to see what God has for us next.
All right, welcome. It's good to see you. I tell you, we feel like we're in a season where we're having to go to school again on learning what it means for us at our different campuses to learn how to reach the community. And that's really true on our Pelham Road campus. But we couldn't be more grateful for all the things that God has done. He has shown His favor towards us. He's been merciful. He's been gracious. And people are telling stories of life change all the time. And we're overwhelmed by that. And though Grace Church didn't start on Pelham Road, Pelham Road is our original campus. It's our first campus. When we were first given the 5 acres and what we now call the Student Center, we raised $150,000 to renovate that building. It had 1981 carpet and some crazy looking windows that we couldn't explain. And just the setup was a way to get in half as many people as what we needed to get in. So we kind of gutted a bunch of things and redid all that. And one day we were up here and we had been working late in the night, early in the mornings. And we were doing most of the renovation by ourselves as a congregation. A third of the room was taken up with choir loft and baptismal pool. And so though we love baptism, we didn't want to give up a third of the room to that. So we got in and we were cutting all the pipes and we're trying to get this big pool out of that room. And so everything that you cut, it just never would come loose. And there was a handful of us working on it and we were really tired and we're starting to get frustrated and I'm starting to get frustrated. And so I just kind of leaned into it and I was getting ready to express my frustration. And Will Terry, who was there, who goes to our downtown campus now, Will and Suzanne, Will goes, "Hey, before you say something that's going to be really, really awkward, I was baptized in this pool." Right? So don't. I was like, I got you. Let's just keep working, right? And so that pool got out, and we renovated that whole room. And I do remember on the night before we moved in, on Saturday night, I left about 2 a.m., and everybody else stayed here and kept working so I could go get a little bit of sleep before I preached the next day. I do remember a skid loader banging on top of that baptismal pool trying to get it down into the dumpster. That was my last scene before I drove here. But we have been grateful that God has blessed us. And as we have seen people leave this campus and go to our other campus, we are having to rebuild our core of those folks who lead on this campus and who do ministry here and who lead all the new people who are coming. So we are working on that. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. We'll continue in this series. If you're new, and I know some of you are, because we're seeing visitors all the time filling out Connect cards on all of our campuses, and Pelham Road is no exception. We're seeing visitors come, and so if you're like, I wonder what we're doing. What we're doing is really, really simple. Okay, I mean, I just gave you a little bit of big picture, strategic vision of what we're doing. It's real simple. We are going to study God's word for a few minutes. We believe it's his breath, it's his voice, he's spoken to us. And then we are going to sing and worship. We'll have 3, 4, 5 songs, who knows, we're crazy. But we will have, and that's a time for us to pray, reflect, meditate. In the service, after the service, we have pastors down front at all of our campuses that you can meet with. Connect card, you can write anything on that card. You're like, I can't use this card because the stuff that's on the card doesn't pertain to me. You just scratch through that. You write whatever you want on the card. It's just a tool. It's a vehicle. Drop it in the offering box along with your huge check. We're good. We're good to go. If the check and the Connect card are close together, you get responded to a lot quicker. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. That's low. I know. Page 720, if your Bible looks like this, if you don't have one, grab one in the seat or Golden Strip and Powdersville, they hand them out. 1 Timothy 3, it's just a couple verses we're going to look at, 2 or 3 verses, and then we'll respond to it. Paul says to Timothy, I'm writing these things to you now, even though I hope to be with you soon. So he says, I'm sending this as a letter. So the New Testament looks very much like our church in some ways, that we are scattered and we're having to communicate and we're not always together, though we'd love to be together. And this new technology of writing letters on Roman roads to get a message out is a radically new idea for this time in history. Even though I hope to be with you soon, so that if I'm delayed, you will know how people or how you or how your people, something like that, that you or how the people must conduct themselves in the household of God. So notice real clearly, he's not apologizing for the fact that he's giving direction. Here's how I want you to conduct yourself or live or act or experience life together. And so he is giving clear direction. And this should define the community of faith and should that should make a clear distinction of how this group of people called the church is going to live and how they're going to behave and how they're going to present themselves. And so for us, that would be as a community where people's lives are changed. The church I grew up in was not known for life change. I'm not beating up. I'm just saying how it was. What we were known for was our Halloween thing. I don't know what you call it. And it was go through the fellowship hall and get scared to death. People bleeding, chainsaws, knives, strobe lights, then go through the graveyard and death. And somehow that made sense to us. That was like, that all made perfect sense. That's what our church was known for, was this extravagant Halloween deal. You go, isn't that the opposite? Of what we're, I don't know. I don't know what we're doing with that. Right? But that's what I grew up in. That's what we were known for. The idea that we'd be known for life change, that wasn't really on the radar. He says, so that you will know how to conduct yourselves in the household of God. He's not talking about how we're going to act while we're in church. He's going to talk about how we're living as the church. And so don't miss the word household before we're not even to the word church yet. That'll come. But to the household of God. He's dealing with the fact that we, under the Father, there's a Father who leads the house, and we are all part of the household. So when he speaks of our conduct, he speaks of it in the context of our identity. And those two things have to stay closely merged or married in your mind. Is that our conduct and our identity are like this. They are married together. So when he says, talks about our conduct, talking about our identity, it's the same thing with your children. So when you're in a restaurant and your children are misbehaving and they have abandoned the values and the expectations, all the training and discipline you've built into them, you sacrifice your life for them and they're acting terrible in a restaurant, what do? You get up, you go to another table and you act like you don't know them. You just disassociate yourself. I mean, there were times when I looked at my wife when they were, we had 4, 6 and under, and I thought, you know what, maybe we just give them the house. We just give them this house and we go start over somewhere. But that's the thing about household. Family gives identity, its values and ideas, its expectations that we train them to before the event, and those two things can't be separated. So if we're like if you come from a place where you don't have a family or you don't have a story, and if you know someone who's in that place, it's difficult to process who you are without a history. And even if you do have a history, If you lose that, it's complicated. So for my brother-in-law, Bob Stahlsmith, the Stahlsmiths go to our Powdersville campus, and I asked for permission to share. He lost both his parents right in his 30s. Mom at the beginning of his 30s, dad at the end of his 30s. I'm probably rounding off a little bit, but within one decade, basically, he loses mom and dad. Instead, he looks at me after his dad's funeral. He goes, "I'm an orphan." I mean, there's just something that is disturbing. I sat at the graveside with my mom when we buried her mom. She had lost her dad a couple decades ago, lost her brother, and then lost her mom. And she looked, I said, "How are we doing?" She goes, "I'm the last one." And out of her immediate family, she's the last one. There's just something that messes with your identity. When you're talking about family, it is the context from which identity flows, and it brings about everything else. The way you think, the way you feel, the way you process, some of which is great, some of which is not so great. You have a family story. And you have all these storylines within the story that define you or that you lean back on. And I have hundreds. I thought about this. I have hundreds of ideas that have implanted themselves in me from my family story. And so I remember my dad talking about taking this big test in grad school. And he just got to this place, he couldn't remember. And he goes, I know this, and I'm just blocked. And he happens to look over and sees it on the next person's paper. He's like, "That is totally it." And then doesn't write in the answer. Because he's like, I couldn't do it on my own. I've known that. I so knew that. Right? And I thought, oh my gosh, that's way more character than I have. I thought, oh goodness. Right? As a little kid, I was like, I'm looking on everybody's papers, right? I'm like, "Hey, can I have your paper? Give it back." Watched my mom go through a real difficult time when my dad had two brain surgeries. And so the family story defines the way that you think. It is not merely, he's not calling on a list of rules, conduct yourself in the household of God. He's leaning on identity. And what he knows is what we're learning is that God has the story that defines what he's doing and our role in it. And we call it with the simple words, creation, fall, redemption, restoration, that this is part of God's story, that God created everything and it had a perfect environment. And you know that. We call it your spiritual memory, which is really your imagination. So if the world was never perfect, then why can you dream of a perfect world? How would you, if there was never any such thing as perfection, then why would you be frustrated with a world that's not perfect now? Why does it bother you that there's abuse? Why do you carry wounds and scars? Why do you imagine a world without disease, without abuse, without war? Why would you even imagine that if it never existed? It's called your spiritual imagination, your spiritual memory. That's the way God created the world, and we corrupted it, which was the fall. And now we lament. We lament loss. We lament death. So why would we lament those things? Why don't we just make peace with them? Because they're not supposed to be here. And we know from our spiritual memory in our imagination that they're not supposed to be here. And there's this redemptive story. Why do we crave redemption? Why do you go to a movie like, I don't get, there's no redemption. Why do we crave redemption in our movies? Why do you crave it for yourself? Why do you wonder if you'll grant it to someone else? And then the idea that the world could be restored. Why do we even have hope? It's deeply planted in us that at some point, all of this could be made right. All of this could be rectified. And if the Bible's true and that story's accurate, then where we're living, it breaks down at some point, but right. But where we're living is really the prologue to the story, is that we're not even in the teeth of the story yet. We're still just living the prologue before the real story begins. So the idea of creation and fall, redemption, this is God's story that we're being drawn into, which becomes the family context that breeds gratefulness and purpose, and energy, and restraint, godliness, holiness, all those things get brought into us, not because we're going to obey a code of rules, but why? Because we're the household. We're in the family. Have a family identity and a family story. And the assumption being that the church, like Israel, was called to be set apart, called to be different, that we would be a part of the world, we would be different than the world. And so all the qualifications we looked at over the last couple of weeks for elders and deacons, those are actually need to all be true of us. And so if you call yourself a believer and you live in the context of abuse, a broken language, a broken mouth, harsh, angry, bitterness, sexual immorality, gossip, slander, if that's the world that you live in, then you're living outside your own story. You're kind of living in contradiction to your own story. So he says, "This I write these things so that you know how to conduct yourself in the household of God." Verse 15, he continues. What is this household of God? He goes, it's the church of the living God, which is the pillar and foundation of the truth. This is the church, the ecclesia, out of ecclesia, these ones who are called out. The ones who are called out, who look differently, who are unique to the world. But don't miss the status. And it's not a prideful status. We don't have a way to process it without pride entering in. So just negate the pride illustration once I give it to you. He goes, this is the church of the living God. It's like saying, you play football? I do play football. Who you play for? Alabama? Okay, that's not normal football. Okay? That isn't exactly... You don't just play, okay, you don't just play football, you play for Alabama. That's a little different level. Okay, it's a little different history, a little different tradition. And so he says, this is the church of the living God. And this God who is living, unquenchably immortal, who gives life to his family. And then he goes, which is the pillar and the foundation. The church is what? The pillar and the foundation of, underline, the truth. Not moral truth. Not absolute truth versus, a relative idea. It's not relativism. It's not that. It is the truth, which we would say is Christianity or the gospel. He's saying that the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth, which is the bad news and the good news. The bad news that we are broken and sinful. And that God entered into the picture. He didn't stand outside merely to judge. He entered in to bring about salvation for us. And so by those who put their faith and their trust in him, they have access to that salvation. He says the church is the pillar and the foundation of truth. Now there's a real point coming. Let's make sure we have this part clear. So we get to the next part and you're like, I can't believe you just said that. All right, so let's get this part clear so that I can limit the number of emails, which I love, but I just want to limit them a little bit. The church equals the pillar and the foundation. So the church is the context for the gospel. Because it's the pillar and the foundation. It is. Here's what's fascinating. When I was living in Dallas, this guy said, hey, we're going to go double date to this restaurant called La Madeleine. I was like, I don't go anywhere named La Madeleine. I'm not doing that. And it was like an early kind of predecessor to Atlanta Bread Company kind of deal, except more girly, okay, for me. And I was like, okay, I'll go. But here I got in there and I saw something I'd never seen before. They're like, you can get this soup. They had these really great soups. I will give them credit for that. It's a girly place, really good soup. And so they said, you can have this soup, but instead of getting it in like a regular bowl, you could get it in a bowl made of bread. I was like, now somebody's doing some thinking, okay? And what happens to all the bread you scoop out? She goes, oh, you get to have that too. I was like, yes, give me some of that, right? And so here's, you gotta love it, right? The bread, the bowl that you get to eat becomes the context. It's what holds, it's the pillar and the platform and the foundation for this soup. These two things, and I learned this in the process, these two things are different yet inseparable. Once this happens, they are inseparable and they work together. And so now when he says, and this is really important, this gospel, this church is of the living God, which is the pillar and foundation of the truth, that it is the church's role and responsibility to carry the truth, the gospel, the core that is Christianity, and these things cannot be separate. You're like, okay, well, sure, that is the universal church, all the believers everywhere in the world. Is that a true statement? That is a true statement. But here's the thing. The last chapter didn't have anything to do with church universal, elders and deacons. What was he talking about? Church local. So is it true that the church universal carries the gospel? Sure it is. That's obviously true. But that ain't what we've been studying. That ain't what he's been saying. The elders are not for the church universal. They're for the church local. The deacons are not for the church universal. They're for the church local. And so the context is still that this gospel, the truth, is embedded in the church. And what it leads us to is that if it's the pillar and foundation of the gospel, of the truth, then that is the primary, most important purpose, goal, orientation, mission of the church. It is what the church is doing. You go, well, okay, obviously. Not really obviously. We are constantly being drawn in other directions. And so let me tell you right now what that means for us. But I'll give you these three things. If I said, give me a practical word on what does it mean for the church to be pillar and foundation. Let me just say this, okay, these three things. The first one is this, is that the church has been entrusted with the reality of who Jesus is. They've been changed by it, and they're taking it to the world. So we've been entrusted. That's the first idea. We've been entrusted with the gospel. The second idea is that we're taking it to the world. It's a unique feature. If you run into a Jew, Old Testament kind of thinker, he just feels no compulsion to take his message of truth to the world. That's not what he's doing. Right? But the church is radically different on that. We've been entrusted with the truth, and then we're also taking the truth outside our walls. We call it engaging. We are engaging the world. And then the third idea is that we're inviting people to be a part of that truth, to be changed by it, and then let God use them to change others. So we are entrusted, we are taking, we are inviting. That is what it means that we are the pillar and the foundation of the gospel, of the truth of the gospel. And here's what that means for us right now. This is really important for us. Because if you take our church, there's hundreds of seasons, different times, churches get caught up on different ideas, different thoughts, and that happens. But for right now, in our history and where we are, it would be a huge temptation for us to become sidelined around, let's say this, all right, you ready? Political ideas. That we would say, the Democratic Party is going to be my hope, or the Republican Party is going to be my hope, or I've abandoned both parties, and the independent, whatever that is going to be my hope. Is that that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put my hope and my faith in that. And it's so interesting. I had two conversations this week. One with someone who's hyper-conservative, and the other one is hyper-liberal, and both good friends of mine. Liberal socially, conservative theologically, in every way. Socially liberal in every kind of category. Check all the way down. And neither one of them could initially process the idea, the difference between a moral issue that the church addresses and a political issue that the church does not address, that becomes a distraction. And so if we're the foundation and pillar of truth, then this certain economic policy by a Mitt Romney or Obama, that is not a moral issue that we as a church are worried about. It may affect me negatively. I may not like it. I may not choose to vote for that platform. But as a gospel orientation, that's not what we're doing. Okay? Or this healthcare policy or whatever. And let me stop. I'm going to go slow here. I'm gonna try to really slow myself down. Am I saying that you shouldn't be in politics? We're going to get it on video. We're going to get it on audio. I'm saying, yes, you should be in politics. Jesus should be involved in everything. You should take Jesus into your school, into your work, into all your belief system, into your pot. That is what we are doing. And he gives us the energy to bring about change and all of that. And the beautiful thing about our experiment is that you can write letters, you can protest, you can march. And if you get locked up, civil disobedience, I'll come visit you. Right? I mean, I'm not even joking. I'm serious. I'll bring you a Snickers bar or something with a saw blade in it or whatever. I don't know. I mean, serious though. It is not about us pulling out of the political deal, but there's a difference in bringing Jesus to the political spectrum and us putting hope in it. Or getting confused and thinking that this party's holy and this party's not. Both parties have proven that there is corruption widespread, right? And I stood in a congressman's office 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and he's new, up and coming in his party, big deal. I sat in there, and the guy that brought me, I was like, hey, he's sleeping with the secretary. He goes, yeah, that is a little bit of a problem. And I was like, I thought this is your new star. He's like, well, other than that one issue, it is. Very conservative agenda here. He's got this, he's got that, he's well thought over here on this idea. I'm like, oh, okay. Oh, that's a little confusing, right? So I had to divorce her. And I'm just saying, there's enough corruption on both sides of the aisle. No one's hands are clean. And so, here's my point for our church. We would never align ourselves as a church with a certain party over non-moral issues which would wind up alienating us from other people who need to hear the gospel. I will not wear anybody's label, no matter how compelling their platform will be, if it's going to alienate me from other folks who are in a different party and prevent me from sharing the gospel, or them discredit me around. I will not let a political persuasion discredit me from being able to share the gospel. And that is just how that has to be. Now, you go, well, so we're not going to take a stand on moral issues. No, we're going to take a stand on moral issues all day because they're moral issues, right? They're not political issues. But let me just say, because we do have lots of Republicans in our church. And I worked in the pro-life movement for a number of years, and we thought 8 years of Reagan and then 4 years of Bush, there was this pro-life kind of deal that we were going to get that overturned, that abortion was going to be overturned, but it didn't happen. And you do have to ask yourself a question. We have a Supreme Court now where five of the nine have been appointed by pro-life presidents, supposedly, yet nothing changes in our court decisions. And so I'm just saying, if you put your hope in something that is man-made, you know that you are going to be let down, right? And so there are great things about this party, and there are broken things about this party. There are great things about this party, and there are broken things about the party. And I see great strengths in both parties. I see brokenness in both parties, right? But I will not wear the label of either one that's going to prevent me, it's going to alienate me from people who need to hear the gospel on both sides. And I know I have offended people on both sides, and I'm really trying to be clear, is that we want you to be involved. You take Jesus everywhere you go, but we cannot get distracted from the point. And when I was in seminary, it was during a political season much like this, and it would have been the night when there was a vice presidential debate, and it was Bush 41 against Clinton, and 41 was his second run, and he was going to lose. You didn't know, and it looked like Clinton was coming out of nowhere. And so we went to a meeting that happened at seminary, and they brought in Chuck Colson to speak. And if you know Chuck Colson, born again, was part of the Nixon administration, part of that corruption, went to prison, got saved, started prison fellowship, died a few years ago. And so he's one of my heroes, right? So we got in there, got there early, sat about two rows behind him, and Vicky said, "This is ridiculous." I was like, "What's ridiculous?" I was like, she said, "You are worshiping him." I was like, "Yes, I am." I mean, I look at his shoes and his suit and his hair's all greased over, and I was like, "Oh my goodness, it's everything I thought. He's wonderful." All right, so I mean, I loved him. And he got up to speak, and he said, and he knew that he was talking to a Republican crowd that night. He knew that's who he was talking to. And he said, "Let me ask you this question. What happens if you put your hope in a political process and you channel money and energy towards that political process and you refuse for 12 years to make disciples, but you put your hope in this system?" He goes, "Then what happens after 12 years of putting your hope in that system, not making disciples? What are you left with as a church if you haven't made disciples for 12 years because you depended on a political characters?" He goes, and the room got quiet. He said, "You're about to find out." And something snapped in me that night. I got really clear that my goal was not to be Democrat. I come from Democrats historically, and not to be a Republican because I got those in my family too. So I've been trained in both. That my goal, my existence on this earth, was to be a pillar and foundation of truth and take the gospel to people. Everything melted away, and I got crystal clear that night of what God had called me to do and what my life was going to be about. Because as much as we want you to be involved in everything macro and trying to change the world, we want to be involved in social cause, political cause. Here's the other thing. We want you to lead someone to faith in Jesus. That's what we want you to do. We want you to love your neighbor or your friend enough to explain to them your story, to give your life away to them. You're like, "Well, I don't know all the answers to all the questions. And since I don't know all the answers to all the questions, I can't share my faith." Here's what I would tell you. You won't know the answers to the questions until you do share your faith. It is in the process of sharing that you actually learn the right answers to the right questions, and not something that you read in a book that says, "Oh, tell them this and then they'll believe." That is not how it works. That is the bigger cause, that the church is tirelessly grassroots. We are tirelessly grassroots. China, the church in China, is exploding, and the government will have none of it. The government doesn't sanction that, doesn't give them freedom for that, and the church is exploding. There will be massive, in 50 years, we will see the massive consequences of underground church for decades and decades and decades building, and then they will, that government will not know what to do with what's going to happen in that country. It is going to be phenomenal to see what happens. And the government is not for them. The government is oppressing them. So to the church is the founder, is the foundation of the pillar of truth. We don't actually need a government to be for us. In fact, Jesus promises that things are going to get worse and going to be difficult. And so when a man stands out front of our church last week and says, let me tell you over the last few years how God has changed me and then changed my wife and changed our family. And then I think to myself, however he votes, whatever else is going, I mean, that's what we want, is that his life was changed one life at a time. Verse 16. He goes, without question, this is the great mystery of our faith. What's the great mystery? He's talking about Jesus. And so he's gonna answer Jesus. But how would you solve the sin problem with the holy God? You would take the scandal of sin and you would meet it with scandal. You take a man who had never sinned and you would place sin on him and create a scandal. And so you would solve scandal with scandal. How would you reconcile people to each other, Jews and Gentiles, men and women, slave and free? Is that you would bring a fracture in the Trinity and you would take the Son and you would exile him and you would cut him off and you would break fellowship with him to bring about payment for sin, to bring those who had broken fellowship, to bring them back in. How would you include all nations? How would you keep this universality of the gospel? How would you send that out to all nations? You take someone who is from the least nation, the least of the least of the least, and you would raise him up and you would sacrifice him and then ultimately ascend him on high, and then you would draw all nations to yourself. It says, Christ was revealed in a human body and vindicated by the Spirit. Now, these three lines are couplets of ideas, and it's, we think this is an early hymn or an early creed, but probably an early hymn of the church. And it's probably a bigger song, and he just, so some of you who love hymns, here you go. This is one of them. Christ was revealed in human body and vindicated by the Spirit. Notice, part of it is body, and so the other part is spirit. They're opposite of each other. So born of a virgin, revealed in human body. He has no human dad, so he has no sin nature. And then he's vindicated by the resurrection. That's what he means, vindicated by the Spirit. He was raised to new life in the Spirit, by the Spirit, and so he's vindicated by the resurrection. Anybody can say they're your Messiah, but the one who gets raised from the dead, the one who passes from life to death, back to life, that's the one you can trust to bring you from where? You're going life, death. Will you come back to life? You need someone who's been through that, who's not just theorizing about that idea, but who can do that for you. He was seen by angels and announced to the nations. So we have this angelic peace and this earthly peace. Angels gives you this idea there's a cosmic viewing going on, and then announced to the nations. That there is no ethnos, no ethnic that is excluded. That he created all the nations, and now he's drawing all the nations back to himself. In the fall, he lost all the nations. Now he's craving and pursuing and calling them all back. He was believed in throughout the world and taken up into glory. So it's poetry, not chronology, right? But the response is that he is believed throughout the world. And so when you go on one of our short-term mission trips, whether you're in a dirt floor church in Kenya, or whether you are in a courtyard in Nicaragua, or you are with a group of folks that you've never seen before in the Bahamas, wherever you are in the world, and you start singing and worshiping, there's a part of you that goes, this feels familiar. These people are from the other side of the world. These people don't look like me. We don't speak the same language. We have nothing in common. We have no common history. But what you feel in the room, you're like, I felt that before. And then she gets up to give her testimony. You're like, oh, I've heard that before. He gets up to share. You're like, hey, that makes sense to me. Is that there is this commonality in the Spirit that the gospel's the same everywhere. He goes, it's been received throughout the world. And then he was taken up into heaven in glory. And so the idea being is that he comes as a baby first time to bring about salvation. He comes next time. He's yet to be revealed. But when he does, he'll be revealed as king. So this has two applications for us. And we'll sing together and we'll worship, right? Is that this is a victory song for the church. Notice how it is victorious throughout it. And it's this story and it's this song. If you know Jesus, get this now. this story, this song is your story. Is that you give your life away because he's now your family, this is now your household. This is your story. It's one of victory. You're able to sacrifice because he sacrificed for you, because you have a future rest, a future victory with him. Is that you get to give your life away. You even take some risk. You remain faithful. You love. You live. You give your life away because this is now your story. He gave his life to you. He gave his life away. You get to give yours away. It's part of the story. And remember when he said, this is how you conduct yourself in the household of God. There's no rules. Here's the 9 things you do. No, wait, there's 10. No, wait, here's the 10 things you don't do. That's not what he's saying. He's saying you conduct yourself in a certain way. You live a certain way. You give your life away. Because you're part of the story, part of the family. It's how dad lives. It's what dad wants for his family. Be focused around a few ideas that are really important to us. This fellowship, studying his word, sharing, giving your life away, giving your words, your story away, inviting other people to be a part of that. It's foundation, pillar of truth. That's what we're doing. And then for those on every campus and every service, we have folks who are not Christians, and we are thrilled that you're here. The fact that you give us a hearing after how badly the church has performed and conducted itself, we're really grateful, all right? But let me just tell you that regardless of what you've seen that discredits, there is a part of you that has a spiritual imagination and a spiritual memory. There's a part of you that knows that something about all this is true. Like there's a lot of it you love to write off, but there's something you cannot ignore it. And what I would tell you is that you have lived your story. And is there any part of you that wonders how you bring it all full circle, how you make it all work? Because this hymn is that he was revealed in human body, vindicated by the Spirit, announced to the nations, taken into glory. Ultimately, he comes back. Jesus is offering his story to you. He's saying, you get to make your story, my story, you get to make that your story. You get to put your faith and trust in me and take my life and my story and make it your own so that you have eternal life and that you have meaning and purpose and energy and vitality in this world because I'm giving it to you. I'm giving you my story. I'm giving you my life. So wherever you are, if you, during a service, you want to come down front and pray with a pastor, after the service, you want to come down front, grab a card, fill it out, say, hey, we're not trying to force people into a decision. This is your call. You're like, it's my life. I got to make it. That's right. Your life. You get to make a decision. Jesus is offering himself. We're the church. We have been entrusted with truth. We are taking it to the world, and we're inviting you to be a part of it. And so we would love to help you think through what does it mean for you to merge your story into his and let him ride over you and give you new life. Let's pray. Father, we are grateful that we get to come under you. And as broken and fallen as we are, you have been patient and kind with us. You have brought to bear a dramatic story on this world. And for those of us who have lived our story, we don't know what it means to follow you, but we've been following us, and we know how that is. We don't know what it means to serve you, but we know we've been serving ourselves, and we know how that's going. And we may not know what it means to be in community with you and fellowship with you, but we know what it's like to be isolated from you. So, Father, the simple idea that for anyone at any campus, in any service, who says, Jesus, I know that I'm a sinner, I move towards you. I put my faith and my trust in you to pay for my sins. I cannot pay for my sins myself. I need you as a sacrifice to pay for my sins. I pray that you would come into me, give me life. Show me what it means to follow you and trust you. Father, would you, for anyone who would call out on you, would you drive those words, whatever, however they want to say it, that you would drive those concepts, those words, those ideas deep into their soul, that you would draw them to yourself and give them life. And that our church would be that place that could nurture them and care for them, that we would make disciples, that would follow you throughout the world. We ask it in your name.